Okay, any preliminary issues? As I've said before, we have today and Monday and Tuesday of next week to devoted to coverage. It would appear that we have a decent chance of actually finishing Chapter 3 before next Tuesday, in which case I will begin Chapter 4. But it's also very possible that we'll either not finish or we will there will be very little left over, so for what that's worth. Again, the exam will cover through Chapter 3, even if we have barely started Chapter 4. Any other housekeeping or other? Mr. Brack. Any time. I'm sorry. I keep forgetting to remind you. If you brought your exam, if you have it with you, I'd be happy to take it. I think Sue also asked you at the time you picked the exam up to return it to her. Some of you have done that directly. It's probably more convenient just to drop it off with me. So anytime you're done with it, I'll take it. Okay? Well, then let's go back to our topic of yesterday, which was the identification of the parties entitled to seek recovery when they suffer emotional injury because of an injury to someone close to them. And just to repeat the general kind of summary here, jurisdictions differ as to how they define that, whether they define it in more rigid terms of saying it's limited to this specific type of relationship. And they also differ as, or alternatively, to say in effect, it's quality rather than label that matters. So that the closeness of the relationship, for example, could be defined in a broad rather than specific way. Let me just point out, for example, that the state of Washington has a specific statute. I think I mentioned it before. It's also mentioned in the Harbison case. The state of Washington by statute says that parents may recover for the injury to the relationship between parent and child caused by an injury to the child or the death of a child. So again, just kind of sitting out there by itself rather than being part of this ongoing judicial evolution, we have a statute that says where a child is injured in that or dies, and that injures the parent-child relationship, the parents have a cause of action for the injury to that relationship. So one jurisdiction essentially picks that out, but leaves other relationships, for example, a child's injury because of the loss of society and companionship of the parent, that's not covered by statute, is left to the courts to evaluate. So again, this varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. The criteria vary, and nobody really has a clear answer as to how logically this area of the law ought to be handled. And again, I've given you these this California triptych in the art history sense of a three-paneled painting of Dillon versus Legg, Rodriguez, and finally Borer as an example of essentially hopeless confusion about how to define the boundary line, at the same time that the court makes a very definitive statement about what is and is not included. So let's start here with borer. Somebody can give us the facts of borer, and we can talk about how the court evaluated this claim for loss of consortium. Go ahead. Let me just pause for a second. What about the father? What about the father's claim? It's not discussed in the case particularly, but what would you think if the father said, I've been injured because of this light fixture falling on my wife? What would the court say to him, Ms. Williams? Yeah, Rodriguez. Rodriguez seems to say that's fine. And so, again, the children step forward, get their place in line at the cashier's window, and say, what about us? Go ahead. And again, if you think about this from the standpoint of how do judges, or I'm thinking of the children's book, I think it's Richard Scarry, the author, you know, what do so-and-so do all day? You know, what do carpenters do all day? What do, always thought it would be helpful to have, what do lawyers do all day? But, you know, from the standpoint that we're saying, what do judges do all day here? How do judges go about framing issues? How do they go about deciding cases? Look at the importance in this case of the fact pattern and the way that it's laid out. We get a very, very incomplete, uncompelling vision of what the children's complaint is. We get the complaint, but we don't get the heartrending story of the gruesomeness of the mother's injury, the trauma it imposes on the children. We just get this flat statement that children are suing for these elements, and then we start talking about, well, let's think for a moment about what this means. And what would you say would be the court's primary concern coming out of this case? I think that covers it pretty well. And what does the dissent say in response to the majority's recitation of all these concerns? Okay, and again, as I think I said at the end of class yesterday, the very same arguments that are raised here by the majority were the ones that they demolished in Rodriguez. The floodgates argument, the double recovery, the speculative nature of the damages, all of these points now suddenly seem persuasive. And you can phrase it harshly as the a trial lawyer might, you know, were you lying then or are you lying now? You know, were you wrong back in Rodriguez to reject these arguments, or were you wrong in Borer to accept them? Is this a sensible line to draw? By the same token, I think as harsh as I may sound with respect to the majority, I would pose this question to the dissent. if you're not planning to draw a line here, is there some other place where the line's going to be easier to draw? Again, perhaps I'm going back to my years of parenting younger children, but there's a sort of attitude that when your child is fussy, you may say, well, gee, why don't we humor them until they fall asleep naturally? The other idea is, you know, when I put them to bed, they're going to be grumpy. I might as well get that over with now and have something left of the evening, rather than hoping this will go away and having 2.5 hours of this kid grumping and ruining both of our evenings. It's going to be unpleasant, but I'll get the unpleasantness out of the way, then he or she will be asleep and I'll have something left of the day. So the court may be saying, in effect, we might as well take our medicine now. No one's going to be happy when we draw this line. The dissent doesn't have in hand a proposal for what standard to draw. If the dissent said, here's our alternative criterion, those relationships are eligible for compensation when ... fill in the blank there, what's the criteria, or what are the criteria you propose, and show us that that's a meaningful line and that it's enforceable and that it's fair. But where the dissent says, in effect, I don't like to have to do this, this is unpleasant, this seems arbitrary, the majority says, in effect, is it ever going to get any easier? If not now, when? First cousins once removed, aunts, uncles, you know, fellow members of the Jack and Jill softball team, you know, what is our point at which we say, no, this doesn't qualify? Mr. Brett. I didn't either. I mean, it turns out that in Dillon, this is a good way of distinguishing cases. Notice that when you say, again, going way back to T.J. Hooper and distinguishing dicta and holding, you can go back and say, oh, yes, but in that case, it was a red Chevrolet. You know, and in our case, we have a blue Chevrolet, so everything's different. And you say, what? You know, why does the color of the car make a difference? You didn't say it made a difference back then. Well, yes, but of course that was... So, again, in Dillon, it turns out that the plaintiff alleged in the complaint that there was physical manifestation of this terrible emotional shock of watching her daughter die. But the court never seems to rely on that. Nothing in what they said in Dillon by way of announcing their ruling, nothing that showed up in Rodriguez seemed to follow that. Does Marianne suffer a physical injury? Unless you think of the loss of her physical relationship with her husband as a physical injury, and that's pretty, that's going pretty far in terms of saying, oh yes, we've consistently imposed this physical injury requirement. It does seem like the court is grasping at straws here to try to explain how it is they can suddenly make at least a right turn, if not a U-turn, on the principles that they announced previously. And again, I don't mean to beat up too much on the court here, except to point out how difficult it is. There simply isn't a nice, clear, tidy answer to this. Everybody winds up saying, you know, you keep asking why, and the court eventually says, because I say so. And maybe there isn't a better answer than that, and as parents know, at some point you get to that point. You say, in effect, I can't give you a better reason, you simply have to accept my authority on this point. Mr. Breck? Courts do not like to overrule previous cases. They will strain and struggle, sometimes contort themselves to avoid overruling a previous case, sometimes because it's partly just their sense of pride, but it's also a way of kind of preserving, postponing a decision until later. For example, this is something in the criminal procedure area where the court has had a difficult time drawing straight lines on exactly what's permissible and what's impermissible. You will have a case confined to its facts, essentially. Again, if it's a blue Chevrolet after 11:30 at night, it's permissible to search it, you know. But otherwise, you can't rely very much on that case. But rather than say this case has been overruled, it is confined to its facts, so that we can keep sort of thinking about this, and maybe later on we'll come up, maybe we'll change our mind and decide that case wasn't so bad after all. But for the moment, we're really not real happy with that case. So again, to the extent that Dylan seems to be going in a more expansive trajectory, by the time of Bohr, the court is saying they want to pull back and say there are limits. Again, notice that in Bohr, allowing this cause of action would multiply by 10 the number of eligible plaintiffs. From the mother, 1, to the mother and her 9 children, 10. That's an increase of, you know, we have 10 plaintiffs in place of 1. That's a big expansion of the guest list, in effect. You know, squeezing another chair in and adding another plate and, you know, silverware for this added guest, you know, that's one thing, but essentially when you've got a dinner for 3 and suddenly you have a dinner for 13, that's a substantial change. And again, part of that is just case selection. So that if you started with a better case to propose to the court, more compelling facts of a kid who was more demonstrably affected by the mother's inability to continue in her role as parent. But I also think that in this case, the parent-child relationship is one where you could assume that the damages awarded to the mother would inure to the benefit of her children. So part of what you might be thinking is, if we want these children to be compensated, if we think they've suffered a real injury, in theory at least, the mother's lawyer, in presenting this case to the jury, in setting the range of compensation, will present the evidence of how the mother formerly was able to perform parental duties, but after the accident, you know, Johnny comes up and says, "Mommy, can you read me a story?" And Mommy says, "It's this medication, you tell the story of how, you know, Mom's just not Mom anymore, you know, and now Johnny's quit his violin lessons and he's got tattoos and, you know," nothing wrong with tattoos, you understand, but, you know, again, in theory, you should be able to present on behalf of the mother, her damages include, in effect, "I suffer because I can't be a mom to my children, at least not as good a mom. This is the mom I used to be. This is the mom I am today because of the defendant's negligence." And in theory, if the jury is responsive to that and gives the mother a big award, she, being the good mom that she is, then uses that compensation to do whatever she can to provide other forms of parental guidance until she gets better or what have you. So, again, you could say to yourself as a judge, I'm not really leaving these children out in the cold. What I'm doing is I'm trusting the mother to funnel the compensation where you, plaintiff, claim it should be going. But by the same logic, you could go back to Rodriguez and say, if in fact these are two devoted spouses, why isn't it that our compensation of Richard would be based in part upon his wife's suffering, and that a big award to him would be used to adjust the compensate for the same kinds of injuries. So why does it work in the parent-child? Why are you reassured in the parent-child context, but you're not reassured in the husband-wife context? Mr. Phillips? Well, again, what's a physical injury as distinguished from an emotional injury? What's a physical manifestation as distinguished from a physical injury? And it's not even clear. They haven't made a new rule. The rule that they've made, again, is not to say children who manifest physical injury may recover, but since the children in this case didn't allege it, we're going to tell them to go away. The court says, remember back in Dillon versus Legg, we said this stuff, but that was a case where there was real physical injury. We haven't seen any physical injury here, but when they get to making a rule, they say there will be no compensation to children for loss of consortium with their parents. Period, end of discussion. Not a one. So again, part of the question is, do you design rules that have these clear, bright, line distinctions? I know who's a spouse, I know who's a child, this one's qualified, this one isn't. Or do you have these more flexible ones, important relationships where there is a dependency and a blah, 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 where, we're kind of open to a variety of different things where now I have to evaluate. Oh yeah, there was a parent-child relationship, but I don't think you guys were very close. Or, well, yeah, you were technically parent-child here, but, it was sort of like parent-child. This was a substitute parent because these parents, he's over at this house all the time. I mean, again, do you want the court to get into this business of making determinations, evaluating the quality? This is precisely what they're doing in Filipides, or arguing about in Filipides, this case before the Washington Supreme Court, where the plaintiffs are saying it's not just a financial relationship that ought to count, it's an emotional relationship, and the defendant arguing for the non-extension of the rule says, in effect, you want to get in that business? You want the courts saying, oh, well, your parent-child relationship was really important, but yours wasn't. I said to somebody after class a couple of days ago a long time ago, I taught family law, and I've been involved in and out of different kinds of family law issues. And one of the questions is, how do you determine custody in a disputed case? And where there is a dissolution of a marriage, and the parents of children are put in court to say, I'm a better parent, and the court is in the business of saying it would be better for Johnny or for Susie to go with the mother than to go with the father. The destruction of that, the destructive capacity of that process, there is typically already animosity between the spouses because of the dissolution of the marriage. And to put them on trial, in effect, for their, the quality of their parenting. And for a judge to make that determination is really destructive. And I thought for a while, I'm not sure I still think this, but I thought for a while that in a lot of cases it would be better for the court to flip a coin, to say, in effect, there probably is a difference, but for me to make a determination and say, at the end of the day, you're a better parent than you are, would do incalculable damage to the whole family. So what I'm going to do is, I'm going to flip a coin, I'll do it in front of you, it came up heads, this child is going to be placed in the custody of the father. And you would say, what? But the more I thought about it, the more I thought, you know, at least in cases where the parents are comparable, whatever superiority there might be of saying the father is a better custodian of the child than the mother, if I were a parent in that situation, you want to imagine myself, I would sooner have the court say, you lost the flip of the coin, than the court say, I've decided your ex-wife is a better custodian of this child than you are. I would go crazy over that. I mean, more crazy than I am. So, again, the part of the question you want to ask, I've said this before, the sort of iatrogenic principle, how much is the court's evaluation of these questions in trying to reach justice or reach truth, does the court in its hubris of thinking it can answer these questions wind up trashing these delicate areas of human life in which there is, you know, somewhere, somebody knows whether my ex-wife or I don't have an ex-wife, hypothetically speaking, whether my ex-wife and I would be, you know, who is the better parent. But I don't want any human being telling me that. Unless I've done something, you know, unless there's a clear differentiation. But, again, these are larger questions. Why don't we move on here, unless somebody has a final... Again, I hate to leave you with so unsatisfying a conclusion here, but again, I want to give you some sense of the parameters of the flexibility, that's sort of the good news and the bad news. It's hard to say on any given set of facts, oh, there's absolutely no way this person is going to recover, or for sure this person is going to be able to recover. You wind up with this kind of set of variables. Yeah. Only to the extent that the statute seems to authorize it. And there again, this is precisely what's at issue in the Filippides case, where a statute that talks about loss of, you know, persons dependent upon the decedent for support, whether that word support just means economic support or whether it also includes emotional support. So, to the extent that a wrongful death statute says you can recover for the loss of support, the court would have to decide, is that restricted to the economic support that the decedent would have provided, or does it include the emotional support, and therefore the plaintiff would be able to say, I want the loss of my father, or the loss of my spouse, or the loss of my whatever. And again, you typically can't tell just by eyeballing the statute, oh, well, of course, this is what this word means. So your task in evaluating the case on behalf of your client is, first of all, to know where the bodies are buried, so to speak. Right here in this phrase, in 8.22.070, where it talks about loss of support, if that means economic support only, And it appears that the decedent wasn't going to provide any economic support. He or she was all done or never was much of an economic provider. Well, it doesn't look like there's much here. But if, on the other hand, that word support means emotional support, why, the plaintiff was very dependent upon the decedent for emotional support, and we could, you know, leave the courtroom with not a dry eye in the house about how much the plaintiff has lost by way of the decedent's death. Go ahead. In which particular case? Right, where there is no death. Again, the difference between these kinds of cases where the victim is alive and the wrongful death kinds of cases where the victim is dead, I'm distinguishing victim and plaintiff. Plaintiff is the related party coming forward saying, I want a recovery because you injured or killed my loved one. The plaintiff's situation in this kind of case is different because it's, for the most part, judge-made law. The judges have a greater degree of flexibility to kind of fashion a remedy that satisfies them. Whereas in the wrongful death cases, at least since, you know, Baker versus Bolton and so forth, it has been assumed that legislatures have preempted the field. And instead of having judges adapt the law of wrongful death as they see fit, it's all in the legislature. If you don't like the remedy, go talk to your state legislature. That's the answer in a case of wrongful death. Whereas if you don't like the remedy in Rodriguez, for example, you say, Supreme Court of California, overrule DeShotel. Give us a different rule, a better rule, a more satisfying rule, a more up-to-date rule. Mr. Brett. That would be part of her pain and suffering. So, again, if I'm representing Mrs. Borer, I've got a personal injury claim against American Airlines, and I'm doing my presentation on damages. I go through all the medical records. I go through the lost wages. I go through, you know, whatever economic loss there are, and then I start Mrs. Borer on, you know, what have you lost? And she says, well, you know, the other night I had to run upstairs for something and I overheard Mary say to Sarah, I would have done this except, you know, Mom just isn't around anymore. Or, you know, there's some heartrending thing about how, you know, and I just, you know, I just died inside when I heard that. And again, if the jury says, what worse thing is there? Cut off my right arm. I wouldn't miss, that's not my right. You know, cut off my left arm, I wouldn't miss it, but don't, you know, take away my ability to be a parent to my child. So, already, without any expansion of the law, she's entitled to her emotional harm. And again, if you do your job right as her advocate, it's going to include all nine children. And I'd go through them one by one. You know, what did I do for, Christopher? What did I do for all of these children? And the jury would get a sense. I mean, maybe the jury would say, whoa, you know, nice try, Mr. Tassel Loafer, Yellow Pages, late night TV 1-800 lawyer. Nice try, but we're not buying. But maybe the jury would say, wow, what a serious injury this was. Don't know. Again, that's what makes this whole business so unpredictable. I don't know what that jury's going to think. She doesn't need a separate cause of action. Again, that's why this section of Chapter 3 deals with what new individuals get to appear at the cashier's window and get a number, you know, like Baskin Robbins. You know, I'm number 28, it's time to serve me. And what the court says here to these nine children is, you don't get a number. We're not serving you today. We're serving your mom. You better hope she brings home enough that she can share with you, but you don't get a place at the cashier's window. Yeah. Have no idea. Well, I think the court would have said, you know, well, why didn't you, in effect? But again, we go back to the same, does double recovery ring our bell? Does the floodgates, you know, ring our bell? Or do we say, ah, come on, you know, juries are capable of working with these things. And again, people have different answers. Why don't we move on here, because I think there's a little bit here in Fortman versus Hemco. It would be nice to even start Fine versus Permanente today, because Fine versus Permanente is directed at, it's a tort reform measure. And it is a way of saying, in effect, this system has spun out of control, at least with respect to medical malpractice. And I at least want to kind of get you thinking about these issues, because they're fairly substantial. But the Fortman case that begins on 105 is, to some extent, I think I've already referenced a lot of the same issues here. The first question, obviously, in this section, let me just transition to the section as a whole. We started with an inventory of damages in Section A. We did these related parties in Section B. Now we're saying, let's assume we know who's entitled to recover. Now, how do we determine the amount of the award? And this first question is, how much is too much or too little? It's more often a question of whether something is too much. And in the Fortman cases, I think I've mentioned before, the award to her is $18 million in compensatory damages and $6 million in it's $18 million of economic loss and $6 million of non-economic loss, pain and suffering. And her injuries are very severe as a result of this, you know, brain damage, spinal cord injury. She's physically severely impaired. She has a five-year-old's intellectual level. All kinds of impairments caused by this injury. So the first question is whether $18 million is too much. The plaintiff presented evidence from an economist showing not only her wage loss, but the primary component of this large economic award was the cost of medical care for 70.9 years, or however long we expect her to live. And again, if you start looking at the trend line for the cost of medical care and you run it out for 70 years, you come up with some pretty big numbers. What did the defendant offer by way of counter evidence? Nothing. And again, as I've said before, you might ask yourself, who was asleep at the switch on that one? But obviously, it was a conscious decision by the defendant not to dignify the plaintiff's astronomical numbers by saying, well, it's really only 16.4 instead of 18, You should have used a multiplier on the federal funds discount rate and the adjustment for the whatever it is. I'm not going to play that game. I'm just going to go to the jury in my closing argument as the defense lawyer and say, $18 million. The one on cross-examination, you'll remember I asked the plaintiff's expert, how much would you earn in a totally safe investment? And he told me that if you gave $18 million, you'd be able to get $800,000 a year without ever touching the principal. And he testified that the cost of her medical care was at most $150,000 a year. Something's wrong here, ladies and gentlemen. But the jury thought, well, something's wrong with you, defense lawyer. We think the economist was believable, and we're going to give that award. Go ahead. You can't make that argument because she didn't die.
But I'm saying, so has the child been lost or killed, there wouldn't have been all this money against it.
We wouldn't have to spend all this money for medical care.
So what I'm saying is, she didn't die. She's still alive. So the parents are getting a tremendous benefit out of it. The child is still being alive.
Remember, the parents are saying, far from being benefited, we now have, do we not, as parents, have the responsibility to provide her with medical care. You know, had she died, of course, we would have, paid for a funeral and we wouldn't have any more medical expenses, but it's not like we're getting any great benefit now that we get to spend all this money. I like to shop, but I don't really like to shop for medical care for my daughter. So, to that extent, the parents, I think, would react quite negatively to the suggestion that they have somehow benefited because their daughter, they would say, I'm glad my daughter is alive. I mean, sometimes I'm sure there are parents who actually feel it's a burden. You know, there would be parents where the child is suffering and they think maybe it would be better if, the angels came and took my little sweetheart away and took her out of this terrible suffering. But that's not for me to decide. Again, the plaintiffs say this is what it's going to cost. And while we're at it, is $6 million too much to compensate for the difference? Again, we talk about what her life, will be like. We wheel her into the courtroom every day, and we make it clear she's not going to the prom. She's not going to be able to go watch her high school football team play. You know, we'll talk about what Halloween is like, or what Easter is like, and what Nicole Fortman says when her younger sister is getting ready to go to school, and Nicole says, Mommy, when will I go to school? If I'm the plaintiff's lawyer, I don't want a dry eye in the house when I'm done. And so the jury is going to say, well, gee, $6 million, that's not too much. And the court says, you're right, that's not too much. That's for the jury to decide. If she'd broken her arm and, dropped 30 points on her bowling average and she wanted $18 million, you'd say, no, that is too much. But for an injury like this, the court says, I mean, this is even back in 1989, again, large awards don't shock the conscience of the court. So again, this only increases, Again, one of the other things I want you to appreciate in a case like the Portman case is the way in which large dollar injury cases like this make plaintiff's lawyers salivate. This is the kind of case you can retire on. And while that's not the only motivation for the plaintiff's lawyer, it certainly is something that motivates you to do a good job with these cases, to find that economist. You interview five different economists. You fly to go meet with them and talk. You talk, to spend hours on the phone to find the right economist who's going to land this big fish. And so the cases kind of take on a life of their own. And again, Nicole Fortman, while this is all about Nicole in one sense, it's a lot about the lawyer too. The lawyer becomes a key component in all of this. And again, it takes us back to the contingency fee issue. When the court affirms this verdict, it's a total of $24 million, eight of which, presumably, maybe nine of this, maybe close to 10 of this, goes to the lawyer. Fair? Unconscionable? But again, from the defendant's standpoint, insurance companies, large institutions, cases like this are the ones, just as they make the plaintiff's lawyer dream, they make institutions think, there goes the neighborhood. That's why we can't afford to do various things. That's why, you know, the world's going to hell in a handbasket. So again, it generates this pressure, at least in the context of something like medical care, for Fine versus Permanente to say, stop the merry-go-round. I want to get off. Let's find a way to limit cases like this. So just again to set up Fine versus, well, obviously we don't have any time for it today. I do want to emphasize, as we'll start this on Monday, this is not a class in constitutional law, but the Constitution does play a role in determining the limits of tort reform. Not here, but we'll see later on courts striking down tort reform, finding that it's unconstitutional. And at least some understanding of this equal protection clause, of the tiers of scrutiny, that some forms of discrimination are subjected to strict scrutiny. Some forms of discrimination are treated to intermediate scrutiny. It's sort of like, you know, Papa Bear's porridge and Mama Bear's porridge and Baby Bear's porridge here. But the bottom tier of scrutiny is this so-called rational relation test. And as you may know, the Massachusetts case that recently struck down the prohibition on gay marriage relied upon this lowest level of rational basis and said, in effect, there is no rational basis for the distinction. So seeing the way in which these constitutional tests are put to work by the court in evaluating what can the legislature do, what may the legislature not do in setting the boundaries of tort liability. So we'll pick up with Fine versus Permanente. Again, I don't want you to, I'm not going to test you on con law for the exam, but I at least want you to have some feel for how this stuff works. Yes, thank you. You can keep that. I just need this. Thank you.
And then, like
yes.
And then,
let me just turn this off here.